We're going to kick off now again, so thank you very much.
Thank you. This is a bit wobbly, but I think the plan is we'll finish. You can leave at 8:30, no problem. Even earlier if you want. I'll be happy to stay around if anybody wants to talk a bit more to me afterwards, so I won't be rushing off. Some great questions. Thank you for those. When I was at school, we were taught that we were heading for an ice age. What happened to change this? Well, we are heading for an ice age. They come about every 110,000 years. We're halfway through now, so if you care to wait 50,000 years, there'll be an ice age. That's what happens. It's the Earth's orbit changing. As I said, the issue now is the rate of change is so rapid that we've got to do something about it on a human timescale. Would we have an ice age, as Al Gore narrated in An Inconvenient Truth? I'm not sure he said there would be an ice age. What he did talk about, I think where he went a bit over the top, and I've heard him speak, he talked about sea level rising massively if the whole Greenland ice cap melted and that sort of thing. And it is true that if the Greenland ice cap melted, there'd be about a 7 metre rise in sea level. Between ice ages and in between ice ages, which we're in between ones now, there's about 120 metre rise in sea level. So certainly Cambridge has had it, and so has London, and most of the rest of England. If you're in the Peak District, you might be okay. But the best estimate for the change this century has been put out by something. I haven't mentioned the IPCC. The IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which puts out reports about every 4 years. Incredibly carefully carefully considered conservative reports. Essentially, all the nations of the world contribute to them. 130 different nations, several thousand scientists. They argue over it for years and years to get it exactly right. All the best research there is. Their best estimate of sea level rise this century is between 0.5 metre and 1 metre. Now, you might say that doesn't sound much, but it's certainly a lot if you live in the Maldives or if you live in Bangladesh or the other 100 million people it will affect who live within a metre of sea level. So I think I want to say you shouldn't be sensationalist. So the pictures Al Gore showed of New York being submerged under the sea, how much you might think that would be a good thing, isn't actually likely to happen, actually. Nor to London in the immediate future. Why is it only now that scientists are telling us how serious it is when the statistics suggest it's been so long observable? I think the point here is that there is uncertainty in this, and I don't want to say it is absolutely certain. We're looking at small changes in big numbers, and scientists have been very careful not to over-egg the case, because if we all said something catastrophic is going to happen, then it doesn't, then people wouldn't believe you. And the IPCC in particular has been very careful. Now, they're very careful about the statistics they use and they define them. So when they say something's very likely, it means it's, I forget the exact statistic, I think it's more than 90% certain. In their last report they put out at the beginning of this year, it's the first time I've ever seen it, they said that climate change, the evidence for climate change is, and they used the word unequivocal. Now, there's absolutely no ambiguity about unequivocal. And it's the first time, and the reason is really that it's just collating the body of evidence, and we've just got better at looking back at the evidence. For instance, you can measure annual layers in ice cores, and a lot of that drilling has only been done in the last few years. So we now have a very accurate measure of the temperature change through the last 100,000 years from measuring annual layers in ice cores, measuring the temperature and the carbon dioxide in those. So I think it's a good thing that people were cautious about it, and they are still being cautious. But if you're cautious and you still say it's unequivocal, I think that's pretty solid evidence. Another question, is the amount of man-made carbon dioxide relatively small compared to natural emissions like volcanoes? Therefore, will our effects to curb output have only a marginal impact on the pace of global warming? Natural emissions, volcanoes actually do put out quite a lot of greenhouse gas briefly, but it gets taken out of the atmosphere very quickly as well. So the issue about humankind's anthropogenic greenhouse gases that humans make is that it's long-term and continual.
Yep. I think that's there are massive numbers of volcanoes underneath the surface on the ocean. That's two-thirds of the world's surface, and
yep.
They're all spewing out stuff. But are you aware of the 120 warm-water geysers, Loch and volcanically fed, that are now have been discovered underneath the Antarctic landmass. This has been acknowledged by IPCC scientists in multiple reports.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the South Pole is cracking up.
Well,
nothing to do with human agency or anything in the atmosphere. That's all because of volcanoes under the ice.
Indeed, yes. I do know about the...
What about those? The 120? The
yeah, I know about the underwater volcanoes because I do research on them on the mid-ocean ridges, in fact.
Yeah. I think the public here should know.
I think that the breakup that's happening in the Antarctic is a floating ice shelf, which people are worried about. It's floating ice, not ice on land. And as I said...
Mm-hmm. When the Russians went to Poland and Boston just earlier this year, the independent report.
Mm-hmm. There certainly is a lot of heat. There's a lot of, I mean, we don't want to get sidetracked into this because there is a lot of heat coming out from the centre of the Earth through volcanic systems, through hot water systems, geysers. I work specifically, do research on the biggest geothermal system in the Northern Hemisphere, which is in Iceland, a place called Torfjökull. So I know about that. But that is small compared to the rate of change of putting greenhouse gases direct into the atmosphere that we're doing by burning fossil fuels. And the reason is that those fossil fuels took millions of years to accumulate, and we're burning them. We've burnt probably about half the reserves of oil that there is in the past 50 years. So I think that it's the rate of change that's the issue. And although the additional amounts are maybe smaller than the amounts which are in the system normally, they are spikes on top of it, which change it very quickly on top of it. So, as I said, there is about 30 degrees C of global warming from greenhouse gases all the time, and it's a jolly good job there is, or it would be minus 18 degrees C here. It's this spike on top of it which is the problem. Here's another really good question. Some Christians are sceptical about man's influence on climate change, and so they argue that money spent on mitigation would be better directed at alleviating poverty and cancelling debt and so on. What should our response be? Now, that is a really good question, and my answer is all of the above. We should be doing all these things, because often the effects of global climate change are affecting the poorest anyway in sub-Saharan Africa. They're the ones that are most vulnerable. So it seems to me that we need to tackle the root causes of that, as well as providing aid and helping them to cope with the changes that are occurring. And to do otherwise would be to be sticking our head in the sand. Now, some of you might have seen there was a report called the Stern Report that came out in November last year. That was an economist looking at global climate change. And he said, well, the risk of the change that might happen is such that it's worth investing 1% of our GDP now, because this is his results, not mine, because we potentially save 5 to 20% down the line. Now, economists can argue about the exact figures, as they always do, what discount rates is used and so on, but you can see the thrust of where he's going, that the risk of the change is so great, even if we're not absolutely certain what it will be, the risk is such that it's worth investing now. And some of the things that we might do would actually improve our quality of life. It's something we talk about in the book. For instance, driving to school a mile in your four-wheel drive to take your kids to school not only produces a lot of carbon dioxide, but a lot of aggro too when you're stuck in the traffic jams. And it's just conceivable that walking to school with them might actually improve your quality of life. Because you actually might talk to them a bit more and, you know, all those things as well. So a lot of things we might do might actually improve our quality of life. And it's astonishing to me that when there's been academic studies done now looking at happiness and well-being, and you'd think, I mean, we always think, the more money we have, the happier we'll be. Well, you only have to look at some of these superstars, so-called, to know that that's not true. But even at an everyday level, I think the level of happiness, the level of well-being in industrialized nations like our own is actually not increasing as income and production increases. And in some ways, it's going down. As we get more and more stuff, we're actually less and less happy. So some of these responses we might make to climate change, even on a personal level, might actually improve our quality of life. So the question as to whether we should spend money on mitigation or alleviating poverty, I think, is all of the above, all those things. And the fact is that the people who are in the most poverty are the ones who can least able to respond to to big changes. As I said, if there's a drought for 2 years and you're a subsistence farmer, you'll starve. So certainly we should be helping remove the causes of it as well as actually helping them out to respond to the everyday changes, I think. And that's certainly that's a sort of humanitarian response, but Stern's response on an economic level.